Right. So that would make today, what was the date? The 8th or 9th? Or
the
8th, okay. May 8th. That's right, because that was Sunday.
Was
May Day.
See which one
those
were.
So, today I think we will be finishing up William James.
Oh, my goodness.
Do I have, I turned it on.
I have to tell you, Don, I was reading this pluralism thing. Read most of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I find it very difficult.
Well, it's very Neoplatonic.
You know, I've said a lot of his other stuff I find reasonably accessible. This one, it just doesn't work.
Well, it's all about metaphysics. I mean, it's not, it's what we call speculative philosophy of religion as opposed to critical philosophy of religion. In other words, it's not about religion. It's, I guess, his religious beliefs, I suppose. And it's all very Neoplatonic, as I have said repeatedly. Let's look at, I thought I'd get a running start here and just read two things. Very carefully, but the problem is I got about a billion of them in here, so I got to find the right one.
I was wondering, how do you know which one it is?
I put a different color.
I do see different color, but how would you know which?
Yeah. But anyway, this is just to kind of.
Is not to know.
This is just kind of to recap a little bit of what we went over last week, just to you kind of get in the mood. Let me go way back. So the very beginning, Tom, is not hard. The first, three chapters, is it, where he sets up this schema here, remember, which you can hardly read, I know, materialism and spiritualism, which in turn divides into dualistic and monistic. Dualistic would be like Thomas Aquinas and people. And then he also calls monistic pantheistic. And that in turn splits into two, where you have absolute idealism, i.e. Hegel, and then what he calls radical empiricism. That's just another name for his pragmatism. So clearly he's going doink, 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 getting down to here. So his big opponent in pluralistic universe is Hegel over here. And and the reason is, the phenomenon, now I've not read Hegel's Logic, but I have read, of course, The Phenomenology of Mind, read it. And he doesn't really come out and say it, but The Phenomenology of Mind is all about consciousness with a capital C. And it's singular, in other words. And so you get the impression that there's just basically one thing out there. And so there's a section that I went over, 2 weeks ago, I guess, I think it was, where he criticizes, for James, Hegelianism is just too extreme. I mean, they're both, of course, spiritualistic and pantheistic, but it is too far on the unity side, and it's as though our individual consciousness is just going to get sucked up into a single entity, and it doesn't have the kind of balance that would comport with our inner experience, really. So he gives three criticisms of the Hegelian sucking up into one single consciousness. And that is that, well, that consciousness, if it's God's consciousness, would be perfect, and all parts of God, all aspects of God would be perfect, and yet we don't experience ourselves as perfect. And furthermore, if all there is a single consciousness, well, that doesn't agree with our inner experience of ourselves as individuals, and is not part of a collective, like the Borg. Remember the Borg, Star Trek? I don't know, maybe you guys didn't watch it as much as we did, but the Borg. And then thirdly, his point is just simply that, it's kind of like the second point, really, that the outer world, wholes are the sum of parts, but in the inner world, it seems like wholes have their existence all by themselves and not as a part of it, as constituted of parts, and yet the Hegelian viewpoint goes way overboard in emphasizing the whole and de-emphasizing the part. So those are his criticisms of Hegelianism. But then after that is where he branches off then talking about the positive, what he actually thinks, as opposed to the just criticizing the Hegelians or Hegel. And so this is what I was going to just reread two passages to kind of remember, because he's setting up his positive views, which you have to wait until I don't know if you got all the way to the last chapter. Well, actually, the very last chapter is called Conclusions. But the penultimate chapter, if you want to call the conclusions a chapter, it's not really, I think, even a chapter. Oh, yeah, it's a lecture. Oh, that's right, these are lectures. Anyway, the continuity of experience is the last chapter before the conclusions. But anyway, to set all that up, he makes a couple of points. And I'll just reread two of them. Well, what must we do in this tragic predicament, he says. For my own part, I have finally found myself compelled to give up the logic fairly, squarely, and irrevocably. It has an imperishable use in human life, but that use is not to make us theoretically acquainted with the essential nature of reality. There's going to be let me say that again. A proper analysis of inner experience will require us to abrogate some of the ways that we feel logically compelled to talk, put it that way. And then the other one, and it's related, of course. The essence of life is its continuously changing character. But our concepts are all discontinuous and fixed. And the only mode of making them coincide with life is by arbitrarily supposing positions of a rest therein. With such arrests, our concepts may be made congruent. But these concepts are not parts of reality, not real positions taken by it, but suppositions taken, notes taken by ourselves. And you can no more dip up the substance of reality with them than you can dip up water with a net, however finely meshed. When we conceptualize, we cut out and fix and exclude everything but what we have fixed. A concept means a that and no other. So along with logic is concepts, and the problem with concepts is that, well, a couple of things. They don't capture the flow of experience. They're fixed, as he says. They don't change. And the other problem is that they can't capture the ambiguity of inner experience. They're very, well, according to James, now Hegel maybe wouldn't agree, but according to James, they have very fine, sharp boundaries. And those sharp boundaries preclude the possibility of, preclude the fuzziness of inner experience. So therefore, logic in our ordinary modes of thinking and concepts are going to be inadequate to describing our inner experience. So he's setting up in those two passages, in those actually two previous chapters, he's setting up this last chapter, which, as I said, is titled The Continuity of Experience. And you know, you can tell just by listening to the title that flow of experience, the stream of experience, as he liked to call it, is going to be central to this. And that's why logic, as we normally think of it, and concepts, they just don't do justice to it. They're too static and too sharp-bounded, you know. So anyway, let's hear what he has to say. Now, I have repeatedly said this is Neoplatonic, right? And it is. I could have brought in some Plotinus and read you some stuff, but Plotinus is all the time insisting that reality as it's truly constituted, and I have that picture up on the board, that triangle, is a one and many. A one and many. In other words, you can't just say it's one, like Hegel, presumably. And you can't just say it's a many, like, you know, a scientific sort of worldview would be. Everything is sort of discrete, and that's that. Somehow, it's both. And I know it doesn't make sense. I know our logic says you got to make a choice between one or the other. Our concepts say they exclude each other. But somehow I'm trying to use words to describe something that's very difficult to put into words. And I'll just say it's a one and many. Whether you're talking about the one versus everything else, or whether you're talking about noose as a whole versus little nooses, or soul as a whole versus all the little souls. Whichever way you look at it, whether vertically or horizontally, however you want to think of it, there's the oneness that's always part of the manyness, and the manyness is always part of the oneness. It's like an octopus, I guess, you know. I mean, the octopus is this thing, you know, and then there's these tentacles going out. That's the way I think of it,
right.
You know. And so the manyness, you and I, are like the tentacles, and then the one, or God, or something, is like the octopus itself, you know. That's the picture. That's the picture. That's Plotinus' picture, and that's William James' picture. And all James is doing is using more modern vocabulary to say basically the same thing. I know he didn't give Plotinus credit. He should, but he didn't. But maybe he didn't know Plotinus very well. Anyway, so let me just read you some of the passages here. Pray go back with me to the lecture before the last and recall what I said about the difficulty of seeing how states of consciousness can compound themselves. That word compounding is the one in manyness. That's his word for that. The difficulty seemed to be the same, you remember, whether we took it in psychology at the composition of finite states of mind out of the simplest finite states, or in metaphysics as the composition, of the absolute mind out of the finite minds in general. It is the general conceptualist difficulty of any one thing being at the same time many things, either at once or in succession. For the abstract concepts of oneness and manyness must needs exclude each other. Right? That's the whole point, right? Many, one and many, they don't, you know, it's one or the other conceptually, but it isn't. In the particular instance that we have dwelt on so long, the one thing is the all form of experience. The many things are the each forms of experience in you and me. Remember, that was another of his little phrases. So that what he called absolute idealism, he also referred to as the all form, and then the radical empiricism he referred to as the each form, right? And he's, you know, once again, they sound mutually exclusive, but they really aren't. It doesn't do justice to our inner experience to say they are. To call them the same, we must treat them as if each were simultaneously its own other, a feat on conceptualist principles impossible of performance. But we got to do it. On the principle of going behind the concept, behind the conceptual function altogether, however, and looking to the more primitive flux of the sensational life for reality's true shape, a way is open to us, as I tried in my last lecture to show. Not only the absolute is its own other, but the simplest bits of immediate but the simplest bits of immediate experience are their own others, if that Hegelian phrase be once for all allowed. The concrete pulses of experience appear pent in by no such definite limits as our conceptual conceptual substitutes for them are confined by. They run into one another continuously and seem to interpenetrate. What we're doing, we're talking about the second to last lecture. This lecture, where he's giving his positive metaphysics. And he had been insisting in the two previous lectures that, first of all, if you really want to give an adequate account of inner experience, you really got to give up logic in our normal sense. And the other thing is, you got to give up the sharp boundaries and static nature of our conceptual framework. And so I was just beginning to read a passage in the second to the last chapter where he is saying, you know, conceptually, one is one, and many is many, and ne'er the twain shall meet. But if you want to give an adequate account of our inner experience and align it with some sort of religious point of view, you got to say the twain shall meet. You got to say that somehow the one is can be many, and somehow the many can be one, and logic and these sharp conceptual boundaries that we operate have to be broken down, so you can see how there can be some sort of bleeding back and forth between the oneness and the manyness. Clearly, you know, the manyness is us, and the oneness is God. I mean, that's where he's going with all this. But as I have said, I don't know how many times now, that's very Neoplatonic. It's what Plotinus was all the time insisting too. It seems like, you know, if you're a phenomenologist, because this is kind of, this is phenomenology really, you're almost required to operate with a different sort of logic from our normal logic, which one could argue is based on outer experience as opposed to inner experience. And that's what Plotinus was always trying to do. He was trying to sort of formulate a different kind of logic to be able to use words to describe inner experience, which is unique. So that's, and James is confronting the same problem. He simply just doesn't give credit where credit's due. I am Plotinus.
Comment here?
Sure, please.
So as I said, I was reading some of that, the lectures. And James says, the only God worthy of the name must be finite.
Oh, yeah, that's in the last one. We'll talk about that.
Well, is that coming
that's
up?
In the conclusion. That's in the conclusion.
Well, I haven't gotten to the conclusion, so he must be repeating.
Oh, well, maybe so. Maybe it's a forward reference.
Well, we can put that aside if you want, because here's my question.
Yeah, yeah.
Related to what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
So, which, when he says that, he means that, well, I guess, is that something can exist outside of God. That's what it means, God is finite.
Okay, yes. Well, he's like, yeah, go ahead, though. Yeah.
So that means, like, your inner experience, some of what you just
mm-hmm.
said,
mm-hmm. No.
can be considered as outside of God, not part of the God space.
But that's not what he's thinking when he says that. When he says, we'll talk about it in just a second, but when he says finite, he means finite in power. No, he's you know, very clear.
Well, there was the omnipotence part he did say, but I also mm-hmm. thought it was sort of range, like I said, outside of
well
experiences you can have that don't need God.
I don't think that's part of it.
But you can put this aside if it's in your path.
Well, no, I mean, since you sort of brought it into this context, I don't think it belongs in this context. He's talking about, really, ultimately, the relationship between us and God. And there is no sharp break. And, of course, this is very heterodox, right? I mean, the whole deal behind the Hebraic worldview is there's God there, and then there's everything else. And there the twain shall meet. Once again, this big gap. For Plotinus, that big gap doesn't exist, nor does it exist for William James. When he talks about God's finitude, he's worrying about the problem of evil and, God's finite power. But, as I say, that's brought up in the last lecture. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't recall, but, yeah, he probably... There's probably
yeah,
a forward reference
more than that. Okay.
Somewhere. Yeah. We'll talk about it. Any other? Okay, let's look at another little quote, or actually a couple of quotes from the second to the last chapter. Penultimate chapter.
Our joke again.
Yeah, that's...
Not
that's
the next to best.
Right, that's our...
or the ultimate, the best ultimate.
Oh, there's another... Oh, there's actually two more. Three more quotes. Oh, my goodness, I forgot. Oh, four more quotes. Five more quotes.
He missed up it, well, messed up his markers.
No.
Just
no,
I
was reading this one, but I didn't see that there's one that starts down here, and that goes to the next page, and when I turn the page, there's two more after that, and then in addition, there's two more coming from this marker. So, okay, well, anyway. Here then, inside of the minimal pulses of experience, is realized that that very inner complexity, which the transcendentalists say only the absolute can generally possess. The gist of the matter is always the same. Something ever goes indissolubly with something else. You cannot separate the same from its other, except by abandoning the real altogether and taking to the conceptual system, which, of course, is misleading because it is so sharply bounded. What is immediately given in the single and particular instance is always something pooled and mutual, something with no dark spot, no point of ignorance. No one elementary bit of reality is eclipsed from the next bit's point of view. If only we take reality sensibly and in small enough pulses, and by us it has to be taken pulse-wise. For our span of consciousness is too short to grasp the larger collectivity of things except nominally and abstractly. If, with all this in our mind, we turn to our own particular predicament, we see that our old objection to the self-compounding of states, remember that compounding, that's his word for what Plotinus calls a one and many, of consciousness, our accusation that it was impossible for purely logical reasons, is unfounded in principle. Every smallest state of consciousness, concretely taken, overflows its own definition. Only concepts are self-identical. Okay, and again, in principle then, the real units of our immediately felt life are unlike the units that intellectualist logic holds to and makes its calculations with. They are not separate from their own others, and you have to take them at widely separated dates to find any two of them that seem unblent. Then indeed they do appear separate even as their concepts are separate. A chasm yawns between them, but the chasm itself is but an intellectualist fiction got by abstracting from the continuous sheet of experiences with which the intermediary time was filled. So you see the same. He's saying the same thing in many different ways, but he's trying to drive home the point, of course, that none of these things, none of these inner states can be separated, you know, with like a big bright line between them. Okay, two more quotes. In principle, then, as I said, intellectualism's edge is broken. It can only approximate to reality, and its logic is inapplicable to our inner life, which spurns its vetoes and mocks at its impossibilities. Every bit of us at every moment is part and parcel of a wider self. It quivers along various radii like the wind rose on a compass. And the actual in it is continuously one with possibles not yet in our present sight. And just as we are co-conscious with our own momentary margin, may we not ourselves form the margin of some more really central self in things which is co-conscious with the whole of us? May not you and I be confluent in a higher consciousness and confluently arrive there, though we know it not? We have reached the point of view from which the self-compounding of mind, remember compounding is his verb for one and many, the self-compounding of mind in its smaller and more accessible portions seems a certain fact, and in which the speculative assumption of a similar but wider compounding in remoter regions must be reckoned with as a legitimate hypothesis. The absolute is not the impossible being I once thought it. Mental facts do function both singly and together at once, and we finite minds may simultaneously be co-conscious with one another in a superhuman intelligence. You get the point? Right. So it's the octopus. You know, you and I are like the tentacles, and then the super consciousness is like the main part of the main part of the octopus. Maybe the tentacles are not aware normally of their connection with the main body of the octopus, but they are.
And so the super consciousness is not the combination of the tentacles.
Exactly.
The thing in the middle.
Yes, exactly. That's why it's important. That's why that's a decent analogy. That's why I sometimes use the word, you know, outgrowths. You know, your consciousness and my kind are just outgrowths of something else, just kind of like a tentacle. You know, if you said the super consciousness was the sum of the parts, well, that's like the outer world, right? I mean, I have a house and I put bricks together and I build a house. It's the sum of the bricks, right? But the inner world has a different logic to it. It's not the whole is the sum of its parts. The whole has a existence all of its own and not as a result of the parts, but the parts are somehow connected with the whole. You know, it's a different conceptual model. Pioneered by Plotinus. Who in turn was dependent, I am quite sure, on ideas from ancient India. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole different story.
So you're making a distinction, or he was, I guess, between the whole is made up of the parts.
Yeah.
And the parts become the whole.
Or better, the parts are I like that word, outgrowths of the whole.
Bottom up or top down?
Well, sort of a top down, I suppose, but
because the way you,
I mean, when you say it that way, anyway, the thing is, in the inner world, wholes have their own existence. Obviously, if I took that house and I destroyed every single brick, the house would be gone, right? So the whole has no existence in and of itself.
Let's take physics again.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, you can get quantum mechanics all the way up, you get atoms and such, and then mm-hmm. eventually you get a table.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So at some point in the hierarchy or the conception, you went from a mm-hmm. bunch of parts mm-hmm. of many, many layers, mm-hmm. and you became a table. Mm-hmm. It's like you became an octopus, mm-hmm. right?
Well, okay,
the consciousness of the octopus mm-hmm. manifested itself at some point. It didn't just become all the parts hooking together.
Well, okay, now you're saying, well, consciousness is an emergent. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's clearly not where James is going.
It's,
I mean, that's looking at it from a materialist perspective. I mean, a materialist, right, over here, I mean, he's all the way over here, mm-hmm. boink and boink, right? Or, yeah, that's the right route. But then you got over here, you got the rival view, a materialist perspective, and then the materialist is faced with the difficulty, well, how do you explain consciousness or my inner experience if everything is just atoms or quarks or whatever, material entities? And so the answer that is frequently used is, well, they're emergents. In other words, just as, say, if I have a little glass that's yellow and another one that's blue and I put them together and I look through, it's green. Okay. The green is not its own entity, but it's dependent for its existence on the blue. It's not reducible. In other words, the green is not reducible to the blue or the yellow, but it's dependent for its existence on the blue and the yellow. And if you take one of the little glasses or whatever it is and smash it, the green disappears.
So similarly, in the octopus example, then the octopus's existence or consciousness is dependent on all these other pieces that made it up.
But not from a material. But you're ducking
the emergence question then.
Well,
what made the octopus conscious?
Here's what's going on. What you're talking about, of course, is an alternative possible explanation of consciousness, right? You're saying, okay, if we're over here, and everything that really exists is just some material entity, period. Mm-hmm. Then how do I explain consciousness? Well, I have this idea of, you know, an emergent property. Okay, that maybe works. He doesn't address that theory, right? He doesn't address that theory. What he's trying to do, he's trying to be a phenomenologist, really. He's trying to explain what inner experience is like and how inner experience is, it can't be chopped up, right? It flows, and I know we apply concepts and so forth, et cetera, but that falsifies it to some degree. He could, but he doesn't. He's attacking Hegel. His main object is Hegel, not the more radical, you know, thing, which would be the materialist.
So he's not addressing why an octopus is conscious.
Or you and I.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
That's fair.
No. Yeah.
To take the analogy really literally, if you chopped off the tentacles,
uh-huh.
something would still be there, but it would be dead.
Yeah.
I'm thinking in terms of, you remember Tinker Toys?
Yeah.
When you, you know, you'd have a round one that had all these holes and you could put spikes in it.
That's right.
And if you took those out, they're gone.
Yeah.
But the thing in the middle is not damaged.
Which
analogy is this?
Well, I mean, that would be, if I could, that's still consistent, of course, with the whole existing on its own and not requiring the parts. Now, as to whether the tentacles die off or get chopped off or something like that, that's a whole different question, right? That has to do with immortality, which is a separate question, just from the question of our relationship to the whole.
Okay, I was just trying to figure out if they are separable.
Oh, I see. Well, you know what? I could imagine
still have an existence, but I
think this is sort of neutral. I can imagine several theologies developing from this octopus idea, and one of them might be
eight, perhaps.
No. One of them. What was that again? What was that snide comment?
Eight different philosophies.
One of the eight might be a theology which says, yes, there is such a thing as damnation. What damnation is the severing of a tentacle or allowing it to wither or something like that. You know, this tentacle just ceases to exist because we don't need it anymore. You know, it's a bad tentacle. We'll get another one, you know. So, I mean, that's neutral is exactly how, a lot of theologies, I think, are consistent with the octopus analogy. And so it's not saying anything one way or the other on immortality, if you want to bring that up. It's just addressing the one question: what is the relationship between the whole and the parts? And the answer is they're not separate, even though conceptually we tend to think that way. But we have to reform our logic in order to create a language in which we can talk meaningfully about inner experience. And against the materialist, even though he doesn't bring it up, he might very well say that the materialist is simply ignoring a whole huge set of data. This is the thing that attracts me about phenomenology. I mean, we have an inner life, and why doesn't that count as data as much as our experience of the outer world? But the materialist is going to say it doesn't count at all. All that counts is what's out there, and I'll try to explain this consciousness business under the assumption that what's out there is all that's really real. And I think the phenomenologist said, well, wait a minute, that's just half of our experience, as it were. So I just think I don't think you could have religion without a phenomenological epistemology. Or at least to allow for the possibility of inner experience. And I guess I would say what I just said a minute ago, that if you allow only what's in the outer experience, then you have an impoverished set of data. So I guess I'd agree with James to that extent.
Well, in the sense, you mean like at the extreme, an emergent philosophy where things bubbled up until they happened.
Yeah.
All the way up to societies and stuff.
Yeah.
You don't need religion for that. Is that what you're getting at?
I mean, you know, consciousness, you know, is kind of an embarrassment for the materialist. So the materialist got to explain it somehow without giving up the materialism. And so they think, aha, there's this idea of emergent properties that are not reducible to but are dependent upon the configuration of the matter underneath. See? So that saves materialism, and you know, while at the same time supposedly explaining consciousness. But on the other side, as I said, you're ignoring half the data, I think. In the fall, you know what we're going to do in the fall? I've got to do this. I don't know if this is a good idea or not. I would like to increase attendance. We used to have 20 people a week. You know, not that long ago, we had 20 people a week. Today we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 of us. That's not good enough, in my opinion. Back when I did the slavery thing, that was many years ago, wasn't it? Like 10, 15 years ago, maybe? I'm sure.
I wasn't here for that.
So you weren't here for that? Really?
Yeah.
Jeez.
I don't think I was here for that either, Don.
Wow. Well, then it was even longer ago. Huh. Well, of course, I've been doing this for 41 years. This is our 41st year. So maybe it was 20 years ago. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, this place was packed. I bet we had 30 people in this room. We had to drag in chairs from someplace else. And I had this whole thing where I assigned... I handed out 3x5 cards to people. Research the election of 1824, for example. Oh, okay. Or, you know, these little things in American history.
Well, that seemed fascinating.
And it was a lot of fun. And people did a really bang-up job.
But I would think that more people could connect to that easier than to, you know,
more abstract kind of stuff, right?
About the fall. You don't.
Well, what of my idea for the fall? I have to save some time to talk about. We got to finish this up. But my idea for the fall is I want to invite some people in and ask them a simple question.
You did mention.
Why are you a Christian?
Okay.
Yeah. You mentioned that.
Oh, I did. Oh, okay. Yeah. And maybe I'll just start with myself. I can do that. You probably won't want to hear what I have to say. Well, maybe you will. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you won't like it, maybe. But anyway.
Well, that's interesting.
Don, why would we not want to hear what you have to say?
After that cliff.
Well, I said, yeah, right. I said maybe I rephrase it, say like it. So I don't know. Well, we'll see. And then if anybody else in the class wants to. But I was thinking about asking Hero, of course. Well, Scott won't be here anymore, but Hero will be here. And then I have some other people that they don't even know. I've been thinking about them, such as Riley Williams. He and I got to be pretty good friends many, many years ago when we came back from a work camp. And I rode with him. I guess I didn't drive there. That's odd. But this is from Grand Rapids. So we had the long ride back, just the two of us. And, of course, we spent a long time talking about theology and whatnot. He's a thoughtful person, you know. And he has his own ideas. I quoted him once, right, not too long ago, in connection with C.S. Lewis. Remember? I said, Riley Williams and C.S. Lewis both think that, you know. So, yeah, I'll invite him in. I hope he accepts. But he doesn't know that yet. And, you know, some people like that is what I have in mind. Maybe that'll be fun for people. The other thing I want to do over the summer is there are three authors whose writings weren't totally destroyed, who opposed Christianity in the early centuries. So I thought that would be interesting. Julian the Apostate being one, Celsus being one, and Porphyry being one. Porphyry was Plotinus's biographer and student. So that would be of interest, I think, just to see what their arguments are. And I don't know. I don't know exactly. But anyway, that's just kind of percolating in my mind. In my consciousness, yes. Well, anyway, let's look at the conclusion. And here is the part that Tom was, referring to earlier. This is a totally different topic. Talking about the problem of evil, once again. The line of least resistance, then, as it seems to me, both in theology and in philosophy, is to accept, along with the superhuman consciousness, the notion that it is not all-embracing. The notion, in other words, that there is a God, but that he is finite, either in power or in knowledge or in both at once. Okay. And then the other one is also short. We are indeed internal parts of God, not external creations. That's certainly heterodox. On any possible reading of the panpsychic system, not the Bible, but the panpsychic system. Yet because God is not the absolute, but is himself a part when the system is conceived pluralistically, his functions can be taken not as wholly dissimilar to those of other smaller parts, as similar to our functions, consequently. So he started with the problem of evil, and this is, you know, of course, this is bothered people for eons, right? And he's saying the same thing as a lot of other people. I can cite Ed Moore, Now, maybe a lot of you don't remember, but you, Sally would remember, and Patty and Marty. No, you wouldn't remember. he was...
You weren't born yet.
You haven't been doing this class that long.
Let me think now. He was here... he was... who was... when Wayne DeHart was here? Or was he before Wayne?
And under...
Well, Carol Gunkel.
I think
right?
so.
Yeah. And actually, Carol left, and then Ed left Moody the next year. They didn't want to take both of them at the same time.
Yeah, but Ed was always the associate.
Yeah, that's right.
We weren't here during the Reagan years. Sorry, Don.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but he would say repeatedly, he said this, he would say, if you read Genesis 1, it says, in the beginning, God, and the earth was without form and void, and God said, blah, 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 right? Well, that says that there was something there, something outside God, right? And that something Ed sort of glossed as the source of evil. And that's, so in other words, God is finite. It's the same move, you may, in somewhat different language, maybe with certain different supporting arguments, but the same idea that, of course, if the problem of evil is simple, right? God is classically omnipotent and benevolent, right? And you can't have both at the same time. That's really what it boils down to. So either God or neither. You can have neither, but not both. So either God is conniving at evil, in which case God's not benevolent, but omnipotent there, or God just can't prevent it, in which case God wishes God could do it, but God can't, as Tom Ord says. Remember when Tom Ord was here a few years ago, and he had just written a book. I'm on his email chain. He's a great self-promoter. He's all the time, you know, he's doing lectures. Now he's touring Europe giving lectures, apparently. Well, anyway, he wrote this book called God Can't. The title says everything, right? It's a very simple book, but I mean, it's simply the idea that God is not omnipotent. Otherwise, how do you deal with the problem of evil? So it's exactly the same as Ed Moore's solution, and exactly the same as what William James is saying here. God, the way he phrased it, in the very first one that I read, right, where he said, "the path, the line of least resistance," he said. I mean, if you had to give up the benevolence or the omnipotence, I would trust that most people would rather give up the omnipotence than the benevolence. Golly days. I mean, talk about a pessimistic theology, the Al-Ghazali kind of thing, which is right up there. Sue, last week, she's not here today, but last week she said something along the same lines. Of course, she worries about it too, right? We all do. And she said, well, the only thing I can think of is the devil, right? Well, okay, then my response is, then you got to ask the question yourself, the question, well, what's the relationship between God and Satan? And if God could override Satan, you're back to the same problem again, right? The devil has got to be, if you got the devil out there, the devil has got to have certain powers that God cannot possibly control. Otherwise, you got the same problem all over again. You're fooling yourself, you know. So you have to ask the sort of second order question then about the relationship between God and Satan. The best thing, I think, and here, remember I said in general, I thought that the writings on religion are much better than the writings on pragmatism, because the latter are rather vague, and I was always dissatisfied. Trying to pin it down is hard. But the stuff, the will to believe, and the varieties of religious experience, pretty good. The best thing of all of that, I think, because I certainly don't buy this stuff. Remember, this is where it goes. This makes him the Kierkegaard light. And, you know, Kierkegaard is Kierkegaard heavy. James is Kierkegaard light. Well, Kierkegaard in any form is not so palatable to me. But the best thing that he says, the idea that is the most pregnant and is worth hanging on to, is the idea of the grandmaster. The chess grandmaster? The chess grandmaster cannot control what the opponent is going to do. Now, there's no sort of mind control there or anything. Also, the chess grandmaster does not know what the opponent is going to do. But the chess grandmaster is such so knowledgeable about the intricacies of the game that the Grandmaster will win. It's just a matter of making the proper counter moves. Well, you know, that's kind of neat. That's a neat analogy.
Yeah.
Because the Grandmaster is not omnipotent, not omniscient, but and yet
knows how to.
Will, yeah, knows how to.
To react.
Yeah.
Will win in the end.
And will win in the end. Yeah.
Well, then he still, that doesn't wash with me.
Oh, okay.
Because he's still omnipotent. It just takes long.
Oh, time. No. But yeah. But the thing is.
If he's always going to win.
But that's not.
He's usually going to win. That's one
no,
thing.
No.
But if he's always going to win, then he is ultimately able to control no matter what these little tentacles or whatever they are do.
But omnipotence would mean that God could control, or the Grandmaster, could control what I do. If I'm the opponent, if the Grandmaster were omnipotent, then I would be like a robot. It. And,
right.
You know, that. So he can't control that.
But he can make what he wants to make
out
of it.
That is true.
And that...
Well, that's not...
To me, that's omnipotent. It's like you could say a boxer.
But
he wins in the end.
That's a good analogy, too.
Time.
Yeah.
But he's going to win.
But omnipotence, the word means that, literally, God can do anything, or the Grandmaster can do anything. That's not true. The Grandmaster cannot control what I do. Let's distinguish between omnipotence and, what should we call it? You know.
Well, let's just take one. Home Depot
guaranteed to win
came around and squashed Hechinger.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And other places, Home Depot was not omnipotent. It took time, and eventually it won, which was inevitable. From a business
perspective. That's a good word.
Right?
How about that?
But it wasn't... Omnipotent means I come in and I crush you like this.
Right.
As opposed to Home Depot outplayed them. And let's be honest that they didn't cheat. Let's just say they won fair and square.
Yeah.
They just outplayed them and had their inevitable victory. That's the Grandmaster.
Yes.
That's a very similar analogy.
But it's not omnipotent.
But it... In the case... I mean, if you use that specifically... some of these hostile takeover type things don't work. Some work, and some don't. We're not saying that anything else can come and overcome God. We're saying eventually He is going to be able to make it like He wants it.
Yes.
Even if, no matter what kind of a pitch you throw at it, he's going to eventually
Hit
it out of the park.
Well, how about let's take Tom's suggestion. Basically, and let's distinguish omnipotence from inevitability. I mean, that's kind of what Tom was saying. We can say that God is not omnipotent, but yet it's inevitable that God will win, and that is true. That's the Grandmaster idea. But I know we're talking about just quibbling over words. We're talking about semantics here.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But literally, if the Grandmaster were omnipotent, then the Grandmaster could control the movements that I make, and certainly. That can't happen. And for that matter, the Grandmaster doesn't know what I'm going to do either. But it is inevitable. It is inevitable that the Grandmaster will win.
Well, that's a distinction without a difference or whatever that phrase.
That is a phrase.
To me.
I don't,
okay. To me. It is,
I don't think it's a distinction.
I can see that it's semantics.
Yeah.
But
The end is the same, but remember the context. The context is to explain evil. So God is not responsible for evil. That is outside God's purview, the idea. It's
limited.
Like what I do in the chess game.
He has limited powers.
Yeah, so God, exactly. So God is not responsible for evil. So even if it's inevitable, even if God's victory is inevitable, the problem of evil is, of course, God's omnipotence, God being able to do anything. Well, God can't prevent evil, so therefore God is not responsible for it. That's the reason we make that move and distinguish between the omnipotence and the inevitability.
Yeah, well, it's just that I have a different definition of omnipotence.
well,
you're
okay.
eventually going well, to be able to control things, then that's omnipotent to me.
Well, if you want to call it omnipotence, then we have to have omnipotence one and omnipotence
we
two.
We can agree to disagree.
But, but put it in the context of the problem of evil. That's why I think it's a clever solution. Yes.
Yeah, I see things very differently, actually. I see more like in materialistic manner, mm-hmm. because I believe that human beings are born with different capacities. Some are very weak, mm-hmm. and they can be manipulated mm-hmm. by very powerful mm-hmm. human beings, mm-hmm. like, you know, Hitler and whatever.
Right.
And or in this country right now,
oh, yes.
I'm thinking about how on earth could people still believe in something which is proven to be wrong, and they still go along with it. So what does it tell you? That it's just simple mind people who cannot tolerate, or they're not capable, they're just being led.
Mm-hmm.
And so there you have a lot of evil there.
True.
So it's, you know, and if you think about it, if you analyze the study, when they have done research on the brains of mm-hmm. people who are murderers, mm-hmm. so these are people who have some faults in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
These are not mm-hmm. normal, neurotypical people.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
there it goes. It is. I don't see it as God or devil there, but I mm-hmm. see as mm-hmm. simple facts that mm-hmm. those parts do not exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had two grandchildren with autism.
Mm-hmm.
From brilliant parents.
Right, right.
And where does it happen? It has to do with God now.
Yeah, yeah.
Just something happened in the third...
Sure.
Third, it messed of while their brain cells have been divided.
Right.
There is no other reason. It's mm-hmm. not that God wanted mm-hmm. them to be born that way.
Right.
Well, although the Islamic guy would say that was God's plan.
Yes,
brain.
He
exactly,
would. Yes,
but
that's
no.
right.
No.
Yeah.
That's...
Well, you hope
reality.
That that's not true,
yeah.
or else you get back to what then God is
and
not.
You know,
benevolent.
I mean, if
yeah.
you believe that God is so wonderful, then why on earth have
of
been
course,
so many wrong things
yeah,
happening throughout history? Millions of people being killed,
exactly.
and horrible things being done. I mean, it's
I
like what? Where was God?
I know.
It's how could He allow this to happen?
Right. That is the problem.
So I.
Now, a lot of people have abandoned religion for exactly that reason.
Right.
That's probably the major reason, don't you think? That
yep, right.
That people
it's
have.
Like it, what?
Yeah.
Don't you have a choir?
I do, yes. Oh, yes, we have.
So
okay, I will talk about Wittgenstein. We have 2 weeks left, right, before
I don't know.
We go to one service. I will talk about the Wittgenstein.
Yeah, we are one service.
Yeah, we are one service.
Well, yeah, but I'm at 10 o'clock is what I'm at. All right.
Isn't Memorial Day 2 weeks?
What was that again?
I guess you're right. I guess we have 2 weekends before.
But Memorial Day, what's today? The 8th, right? 15, 22, 29, I guess, yeah. Yeah, that's it. All right.
Thanks.
See ya.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
But I had to practice it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've listened to it at home several times, and
so
I just realized, no, this isn't going to be enough, and even 15 minutes.